From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, as Upfronts Week comes to a close, we'll talk about some new TV shows, the ones that got canceled, and the two series that are getting revived, zombie style. Then, with rock and roll bands no longer headlining Coachella and other top festivals, is rock and roll finally dead?
What we define rock to be has to be malleable. You know, it's not one thing. It's not classic rock, which I think is what we generally associate it with.
And Canadian country singer Lindy Ortega tells us how, on her latest album, she finally found liberty. All that coming right up. The end of the road is in sight for Jane the Virgin, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, and iZombie. The CW network announced today that all three shows will have their final episodes when the upcoming season concludes. The news comes on the last day of Upfronts Week. That's when the broadcast networks talk up their new fall TV shows to advertisers in a multi-billion dollar sales spectacular. It's also a time for sometimes expected and sometimes shocking announcements about existing TV shows, whether they'll be canceled, renewed, or in some rare cases, canceled and then renewed by another network. When I spoke with Hollywood Reporter TV critic Daniel Feinberg about some of the biggest surprises of Upfronts Week, we agreed it's kind of like heading into an Avengers movie. You're wondering who's in, who's out, and who's going to get killed off.
Geez, see, now you have me trying to think of who's Captain America in this situation and who's Spider-Man. And basically, I mean, we know that the network executives are all Thanos. So, you know, they kill 50% of all TV shows, and that's just what they do. We know that much. What was a big surprise? Well, the biggest surprise was the one that got undone. The biggest surprise, without any question, was Brooklyn Nine-Nine getting canceled by Fox. And the outrage surrounding that cancellation was so loud, so immediate, and so driven by Lin-Manuel Miranda that it was undone the very next day when NBC picked up the show.
And how unusual is that for a show to get canceled and within mere hours for it to be revived by another network?
Oh, the speed was what was remarkable here. I think that these days you can probably count on every season or two, some show finding another home. I think that happens at this point. We know how it goes. Last year, I think it took a few days for NBC to decide that Timeless needed to come back, needed to be uncanceled. Speaking of, Timeless has yet to be renewed this year, so that's a whole other thing. But no, it was the speed with which Fox canceled it. Twitter and the rest of the internet blew up. And NBC said, okay, but even if it hadn't been NBC, it felt like there were other homes for that show. TBS has the off-network syndication for it, so maybe that was going to be a home for it. Hulu is part of the same family, so maybe that was going to be a part of it. I think almost everyone knew as soon as the choice had been made that someone was going to step up and say, okay, have another 13, have another 22, have a few more episodes, Brooklyn.
Let me ask you about this, too, because Fox also did the reverse. They picked up Last Man Standing after ABC let it go.
I think that the reaction on one side was, oh, God, there goes Fox basically giving up on doing good programming. They're just going for right down the middle, broad, whatever, Tim Allen, Roseanne effect, Trump, blah, blah, blah. And then on the other hand, you had people saying, look, the ratings for Last Man Standing were pretty good on ABC, and so good for Fox for deciding that they want to actually get a broader audience. And I can see both sides, because honestly, I'm not going to watch Last Man Standing, but I'll guarantee you Last Man Standing is going to draw more viewers than Brooklyn Nine-Nine did. So you got to look at it from both sides.
It seems both unfair and unprofessional to judge a show just based on a trailer, but we're neither fair nor professional. So based on the trailers that we have seen, what caught your eye? What looks promising, even if it was only a couple minutes preview of an upcoming series?
I think the thing that's most notable is how none of it is designed to catch my eye. I think it's all designed to catch the eyes of people who recognize it from somewhere. So yesterday was CBS's day, and CBS's biggest name productions in 2018, you might want to check your clock or your calendar or whatever, in 2018 are Magnum P.I. and Murphy Brown. So What looks interesting? Fox's The Passage looks interesting because it's a very, very ambitious series of books by Justin Cronin, a vampire series, and the pilot has been under several forms of redevelopment and stars Mark Paul Gosselaar. It looks like it might be okay, but I'm really more curious to see what it looks like after all the permutations. There are a bunch of shows out there that are trying desperately to make audiences cry. There's The Village on NBC, which so clearly is trying to be This Is Us. It's about the lives of people intertwining in a Brooklyn apartment building. For heaven's sakes, it has a three-legged dog in it. Once you have a three-legged dog in your trailer, you are just pulling on the heartstrings so aggressively that it would take someone dead inside to not at least go, okay, fine, I'll watch that with a box of Kleenex nearby. And I think there are a few of those shows on different networks. ABC has one about friends coping with the suicide of one of their friends. These are shows that look like they're trying to be This Is Us-style shows without necessarily fully grasping what worked on This Is Us, but that's what the broadcast business is all about, is not quite understanding what was successful, but trying to reproduce it anyway.
Stepping back from everything, a year ago, CBS presented its lineup, and it was all white guys basically anchoring their shows. Did it feel like not just CBS, but all of the networks were taking a broader approach in terms of the people who were not only on screen, but also behind the scenes, the showrunners, the creators, and the cast? Did it look a little bit more diverse than it has in recent memory?
Oh, without any question, CBS got a memo. If you look at CBS's lineup, you would actually go, wow, that's actually really diverse. And if you look at the people writing the shows, there is a sign that there's more of that. If you look at the directors on the shows, there are a number of women who directed pilots that were picked up to series this year. Last year was a horrible embarrassment in that respect, the utter absence of women directing pilots. This year, it was, let's see, not a sheer embarrassment. It was lower number than it should be, but not horrifyingly low. How about that? Progress. It's step by step, and you actually can see it if you look at these shows. It's not a done deal, though.
Daniel Feinberg is a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. Daniel, always a pleasure to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, Neil Young sang that rock and roll is here to stay, but did he speak too soon? If you take one look at the Billboard Top 40 charts or the most popular artists on Spotify, one thing becomes obvious, and that is rock and roll just isn't very popular these days, at least as rock and roll has been defined in the past. The Coachella Festival in its early years was dominated by indie rock bands, but this year Beyoncé's headlining performances was all that anyone was talking about. Add to that the recent bankruptcy by guitar maker Gibson, and you've got some music journalists talking once again about the death of rock and roll. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame recently inducted its latest class: Bon Jovi, The Cars, Dire Straits, The Moody Blues, Nina Simone, and Sister Rosetta Tharpe. Not exactly all rock and rollers, are they? For more on this, I'm joined by Shirley Helperin. She's executive music editor for Variety, and Roy Traken, a pop culture critic. And to start, I asked Traken to give us his thoughts on what this year's Rock and Roll Hall of Fame class says about the state of rock.
I think we're sort of getting to the bottom of the barrel in terms of the, especially the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. Best example of this fact is that, this year's batch is headlined by Jon Bon Jovi. The state of what is called rock and roll at this point, there are a lot of different sorts of opinions. And at this point, in terms of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, it seems like this sort of the lesser talents are starting to get inducted.
Surely, does that mean that those who are worthy or those who are real rockers have already been honored, or that the definition of what is and is not rock is expanding at the same time, or maybe a little bit of both?
Well, I think the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame has this identity problem just by using the word rock and roll, because it has changed so much. It has morphed so much, and it really is not about rock music. You know, NWA was inducted. That's not a rock group.
Well, if we were to look at what audiences and record buyers and music listeners are doing, What does that say about the state of rock and roll? What do the charts tell us about where things are going?
So it's interesting. I mean, there are certain formats where rock continues to thrive, like the album format. It is the number one genre for someone who is going to buy a full album, even though on the song consumption side of things, it's rap and hip hop. But rock still comes in number two. And I think it's because rock has a very wide sort of palette. And many kinds of pop-leaning acts can be considered rock in their own way. We just had Pete Wentz from Fall Out Boy write an essay for Variety about what does rock mean today. And what he was saying was basically that what we define rock to be has to be malleable. You know, it's not one thing. It's not classic rock, which I think is what we generally associate it with.
And Roy?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I just had a conversation with John Landau recently, who's a very important member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and the nominating committee. And he said what he's looking for in terms of inducting acts is what Berry Gordy called the sound of young America, which could be anything. I mean, it could be rock and roll, it could be soul, it could be hip hop. But if you're talking about traditional rock, guitar, bass, drums, I think that is evolving into something else right now.
How much are the economics of the music business driving this? Because it used to be that you could make money just playing music. And now it's all about the merch and the ticket sales when you're touring. Does that favor a certain kind of act? And does that mean that if you don't choose wisely, you're not going to be able to succeed and make a living playing music if you're not in a category that's going to do a lot of big ticket sales and sell a lot of merch?
Yeah, I think it's like you almost have to want to be a legacy act, because those legacy acts or heritage acts are the ones who do gangbusters on the road. In fact, I heard from a concert industry insider once that the way that they judge the summer concert season is based upon how many stadium shows Def Leppard has booked. If it's like 12 to 14 in a summer, it's a good season. If it's 7 or 8, it's not so great. So it's like Def Leppard, who haven't had a hit since, you know, the 90s probably, you know, continue to tour and sell out stadiums. And that tells you that the rock heritage market is still incredibly vibrant and people are buying the tickets and they are buying the merch. And most importantly, they're buying sodas, they're buying hamburgers,
they're
paying
they're
for parking.
Yes.
Yeah, that's how the music industry makes its money. So again, it's like one of these things where I want to say that there's a silo of rock that's doing really well, but it's bigger than that on the road. It really commands the road.
Right. It's still a major attraction, certainly. And Shirley, you pointed out Def Leppard. They are touring with Journey right now, and it's a huge success. It's selling out everywhere. It's selling out 18,000-seat arenas, which is incredible, considering Journey doesn't even have their original lead singer.
And,
but the question is, how is it going to evolve? And are we going to have these holograms? Are we going to have symphony orchestras playing the music of Led Zeppelin? How is this music going to be preserved? You know, we've already seen what the Eagles are doing, replacing members with second generation.
That's right.
A corporation, and these brands, it's brands more than bands.
Yes.
And these brands will exist even when the members themselves start to knock off, as we've seen.
We're talking with Shirley Halperin, executive editor for music at Variety, and pop culture critic Roy Trakin, who writes for Variety. Roy, I want to ask you about a band named Greta Van Fleet. This is the song Highway Tune. So I could be catty and say it sounds like discount Robert Plant, but I won't. Tell me about Greta Van Fleet and why you like it.
They're proud of that legacy, and they don't deny it. And, you know, they embrace the term the next Led Zeppelin. And, you know, these are kids. They're barely out of their 20s, and they're steeped in this music. It comes to them honestly. You know, they're not putting anything on. This is the way they sound. They come from a small town in Michigan. And, you know, that's the hope for the next generation, that they go forward, but also look back at what brought them there, just as the rock in the 60s did.
So, Shirley, that's a really interesting idea, the whole idea of being derivative yet original at the same time. When you think about the rock bands that maybe you saw at Coachella, did you start thinking about that, like who is original and who reminds me of somebody I've heard before? And did some bands stick out as actually being kind of unique in that they have a new sound and a new style.
Well, there are very few rock acts at Coachella this year. But I will say that, you know, as someone who covers the pop charts pretty fanatically at Variety, every couple of years you have a Portugal the Man or even a Gautier pop up who are essentially indie artists, and they manage to cross over. There might not even be a guitar, but it still feels like a rock band.
Let's listen to a little bit of Portugal the Man. So, Roy, you did a piece where you talked to the frontman for Portugal the Man. His name is not Portugal, it's John Gurley. And he said, and I'm quoting him now, rock and roll is very shook right now. It's too formalized with its own rules and regulations. You just can't be a rock star by rehashing things you've seen or done before. Bring something new, which is what hip-hop does best. What is he onto there?
You know, anything that kind of, you know, smacks of rock and roll and white rock and roll in particular is almost like uncool right now.
Right.
You know, rock and roll is just the big band swing or the jazz, you know, of a previous generation. It's been commodified and put in a niche and, you know, has its formalistic qualities that, you know, maybe some are tweaking these days, but not enough.
I want to ask you about something else, and that even as Def Leppard and Journey are selling far more tickets than they should, something else is happening, and that is that a generation of people, I think we can agree, we're rockers, are no longer with us. David Bowie, Chuck Berry, Tom Petty. What does that suggest in terms of, you know, who is no longer with us and the people who are hanging on playing the music that is probably associated with that era?
I mean, the thing that I find saddest beyond just the fact that these people are no longer with us is that people won't be able to see them play guitar. And I think we're seeing like Gibson, you know, going through bankruptcy right now. Like they just won't be able to see that tremendous talent, which got so many people hooked onto rock music in the first place with their own eyes. And that I think is really sad.
I think it's a really interesting point, Roy. Gibson Guitars did just file for bankruptcy filing. And is it too easy to kind of conflate the two, or are they in some way connected?
Yeah, it's certainly collateral damage, isn't it? And I mean, when you talk about rock and roll, as I say, you talk about guitar, bass, drums. That's, you know, I mean, that sort of defines what it came out of. But again, if you look at the history of popular music, the instruments change, the modes of distribution change, the sounds change, the idea of rhythm changes, nothing stays the same. And so in terms of making a living at it and making a dent, yeah, it becomes a little more difficult. And you have to think about a little more than just the music itself, because it's a whole ecosystem to build.
Shirley and Roy, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Coming up, Lindy Ortega rediscovers her personal and musical heritage. Now let's meet Canadian singer-songwriter Lindy Ortega. She got her start writing music and playing gigs in her hometown of Toronto. Then she spent 5 years on the scene in Nashville. She's now back in Canada, and she recently released her fifth full-length album. It's called Liberty. It's a three-part concept record inspired by spaghetti westerns, Ennio Morricone's film scores, and Quentin Tarantino movies. And it also explores Ortega's Mexican, Canadian, Irish heritage. Frame producer Michelle Land sat down with the musician to talk about her career and the making of Liberty.
Hello, my name is Lindy Ortega, and I am a singer-songwriter.
He had hair down to his shoulders in a white cowboy hat.
My dad was in a Latin band when I was growing up. I remember seeing his rehearsals, and his band would back up different sort of beautiful Latino women who would sing, and they would do sort of cover songs. And I was always sort of enamored by their beauty and their music and the way they sung. So I think that sort of planted a seed in my brain to want to be just like them.
Pablo Amadori.
I grew up in a little town called Pickering, Ontario, which is about 30 minutes east of the major city, Toronto. I lived at home till I was about 25. My parents then, they got divorced, and that's when I sort of moved out on my own. So my parents were actually quite shocked when I said I was going to move to Nashville. It was very shocking to them because they never thought that I would be the type of person to do that. But I really just wanted to challenge myself. And I also, you know, the kind of music that I was making wasn't very popular in the city that I was growing up at, and there weren't a whole lot of places to play. I felt like I needed to go somewhere where it might be more accepted, the kind of music that I was playing. The title of the album is based on the song Liberty, which was the first song that sort of sparked the whole idea for the record. It is really sort of reflective of where I feel that I am in my life. I almost gave up music, and I was at a very low point with all that, and I left my record label, I left my management and my agent, and I wasn't sure anyone was going to want to work with me after that, and if I was going to be able to pick myself up and continue to make music. My liberation was being able to not sign another record deal and put out releases myself. And that was very liberating. And in doing that, I was able to maintain creative control of what I do, which was also liberating. Personally, just my own struggles that I've dealt with my whole life, I feel like I'm finally at a point now that I'm in my late 30s. A lot of the things that held me down, I feel sort of a freedom from, and it's so nice to be in that spot. So I felt like I battled these demons and I've come out sort of victorious, and that's my own liberty, which is reflected in the record. And I wanted everybody who listens to the record to find their own sense of liberty through the songs. This record was very influenced by like spaghetti western style music, Ennio Morricone, and as well as Quentin Tarantino, who I'm a huge fan of. I love all of his movies, but I particularly am fond of his choices in songs for the soundtracks of his movies. I definitely wanted this record to have a cinematic feel because the journey of the concept felt very epic to me, and I felt like it needed to have that spectacular kind of cinema feel to it. I think as well as a little bit of like Mexican ranchera vibe. I love the Canciones de Mi Padre record by Linda Ronstadt. So I listened to that quite a fair bit before recording, and so I feel like little snippets of that find its way into the music as well. For me, the most rewarding part of making music is the fact that people somehow connect to it. I'm quite introverted, and I've dealt with depression and anxiety and panic attacks in my life. But music is the one thing that allowed me to feel a connection and realize that these things that I'm going through and these struggles that I have that I write about, other people have those struggles too. And that's how we can all relate to each other. And that's been really the most rewarding and amazing thing for me. Of course, the industry, it's not lucrative. I don't make a lot of money doing what I do. There was moments where I thought of giving it up, but it's really the connection to the fans and hearing their stories about how certain songs of mine have helped them through things that make me feel like I have a duty to keep going.
Some lovers meet out in the street. They make out, move in and move on.
And that is The Frame for today. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. You will find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Some folks will follow whoever they feel. We'll make them feel good for us.